In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today it's time for part one of our conversation with Tony Harris. And it's interesting timing, too, because we talk a lot about Ex Machina, the series from Wildstorm, and it was recorded just before the headlines hit that Wildstorm was being folded into the regular DC universe. As a consequence, Tony doesn't have any direct quotes about the closing down of Wildstorm, but certainly has good things to say about their editors. In part one, Tony takes us through his comic career, from his co-founding of Gaijin Studios in Atlanta to hooking up with James Robinson for his 40 issues of Starman. You'll hear fond reflections about working with the legendary editor Archie Goodwin and how Archie's adaptation of Star Wars The Empire Strikes Back with Al Williamson was responsible for Tony's first attempt at drawing comics. Then we go into detail about Ex Machina, from Tony's first discussions with Brian K. Vaughan and the early designs for the look of the Great Machine's costume to the very last issue. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where they have a wide selection of hardbacks, trade paperbacks, archive editions, omnibus editions, essentials, showcases, in some cases up to 42% off the standard retail price. In fact, DC, Marvel, and Image, you'll find values of 37% off the retail price at InStockTrades.com. For Dark Horse, 42% off the standard retail price. Case in point, specifically Tony Harris's work on Ex Machina. All the trade paperbacks retail for $12.99, but at InStockTrades.com, you'll find them at $8.18. You can also look at Tony's retrospective of 20 years of art called Art and Skullduggery, Tony Harris, from IDW. The standard retail price is $49.99, but at InStockTrades.com, it's just $34.99. Check out all the details that are waiting for you at InStockTrades.com, and don't forget, for your monthly pre-order needs, go to their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at DCBService.com. The conversation begins with the fact that Tony has just come off 60 issues of Starman in 5 years, and I wonder what it was like to be on a book that long and live with it day in and day out, month after month.
The only other person I spoke to who's had a long run on a book that had wrapped up was Azzarello, about 100 Bullets, and he was very fast to point out that, because I'm like, man, it must be tough living with a book like that for such a long period of time. And he said that's nothing compared to what Eduardo had to go through. So being the art guy on a book like that, I can't imagine what it's like to really live with, you know, Ex Machina for such a long period of time. Not only that, but also, you know, coming off of Starman, too.
Yeah, it's bittersweet. as you pointed out, it's only the second monthly I've done in 21 years, for very good reasons, because, I mean, I've been offered a lot of stuff over the years. I could have done a ton of mainstream stuff monthly, from Batman to Hulk, do you name it. But it just wasn't, to me, it wasn't the right stuff. And so it had to be something that I felt like I could see myself doing in perpetuity if we struck the right note with people.
Sure.
You know? And obviously Starman was early on, and my first real major opportunity. So I just felt fortunate at that point just to be, you know, hired and have a job. And we did interviews over the years, and Archie did and James did, and nobody expected me to stay longer than about 6 issues.
really?
Well, no, because, I mean, my reputation was shit at that point for as far as being able to meet deadlines and whatnot, and I had a pretty major bad turn in my life after I spent a year in Atlanta after I co-founded Gaijin with those guys. I kind of had a nervous breakdown. A lot of personal shit went really bad for me, and I split from Atlanta, left Gaijin, and came back to Macon, and holed up with Craig Hamilton, who was my original mentor.
Okay.
When I first got in the business, and I kind of had to start over. I'd been in the business for about a year and a half at that point, and had a lot of contacts, had done a ton of work for the independent market, and, I mean, anything from Doc Savage to, Nightmare on Elm Street, Twilight Zone, Planet of the Apes, Nightbreed at Epic, and did some inking over Jason Pearson on Legion of Superheroes, and Hulk and Punisher, just, you know, whatever came my way. And when that shit happened, and I split and left the studio, I literally lost every contact that I had and had to completely start over from scratch. So I had to rebuild my house, so to speak, professionally and personally and everything.
Okay.
And James Robinson and myself had met at San Diego during that year that I'd spent at Gaijin. And he was, I think he'd already done Golden Age at that point, and he was definitely on the rise. And we met at the show, and he just loved, had seen my stuff, I have no idea on what, but really liked it, and said, hey, I have this book that I want to do called Starman, and the characters had kind of a bumpy past, you know, some hits and some misses. The last miss being the James's opinion being the Will Payton stuff. And he said, do you want to take a look at it? I said, sure, I'd love to. And I can't remember if he actually had the pitch with him at San Diego or if he sent it to me later. But at any rate, I read it and I thought, okay, this is kind of cool. This is like an ongoing thing. And we're like taking some old clay and reintroducing water to it.
Mm-hmm.
And remolding it into something new, which was really attractive. And but then all that stuff happened to me, and James and I lost touch. And in the interim, James and my, at that point, ex-studio partner, Cully Hamner, had done Firearm at Malibu. And so James had a history with Cully, and he knew the studio well. So I had heard through the grapevine, as I started to rebuild my life, that James thought that I was no longer interested in Starman and started to look for another artist. And because he'd worked with Cully, he went to him, because our styles at that point were not dissimilar.
Sure.
And I immediately started making phone calls, and at that point there was no email, so I couldn't do that.
Okay.
But I just started tracking down everybody I could that might have contact info for James, and sending the word out that no, I still want to do it. I want to do it, please. And so it got to James, and out of the blue, I got a call from Kevin Dooley to do a short story for Green Lantern Corps Quarterly with Ron Mars. And I don't know if Ron suggested me for the job or what, but at any rate, I heard later after I did this gig, which was really, really fun, and I asked for Wade Von Graubatcher, who was my anchor on Starman, who was also our studio assistant at Gaijin. And so we did that gig, and then I later found out that Archie Goodwin and James were both kind of watching that job, I guess, for lack of a better term, is kind of a test to see if I could produce and turn stuff in. and then I was offered Starman very shortly after that.
That's cool. Well, and I'm curious about working with Archie. I always want to ask guys who work directly with Archie Goodwin what he was like. His reputation precedes him, and I've always enjoyed his writing, and it figures that a lot of books that I really enjoy from various creators, it usually ends up that Archie was an editor or the guy that put two guys together in some capacity. So, yeah, tell me about Archie.
Okay. Let me just preface that by saying one last thing about living with a book for a long period of time,
sure.
Specifically Starman. So I had all that history building up to me actually getting the job. And then later found out that they never expected me to stay. And I left at issue 45, I believe, which was post-Archie's passing.
Yes.
But James and I were, it was like we were doing a creator-owned book. It wasn't like we were doing company-owned stuff. We got to use Batman and Captain Marvel and, you know, Alan Scott and all these really amazing characters, you know, inside the book. But us having created Jack and his brother David and reinventing the Shade and the Mist and all that stuff, it really was like doing a creator-run book, and everybody kind of left us alone. And I always like to say that Archie, you know, always gave us enough rope to hang ourselves, but we never quite did it. So it felt wonderful to be on the book as long as I was on it. And then, of course, later on, Ex Machina. But Archie was, I feel like I just kind of fucking lucked into him. I got into the business, you know, at a time when he was in a position of power at DC, and as you mentioned before, I mean, his reputation just absolutely precedes him, and you don't have to tell anybody who knows anything about comics who Archie is. I mean, Jesus. But I didn't start reading comics until I was 19. I never collected and in earnest at all until after I graduated from high school. But the exception to that, and I swear to Christ this is the truth, I'm not bullshitting you. When I was 12 years old, I bought a paperback book size edition of Archie's The Empire Strikes Back that he did with Al.
Mm-hmm. Al Williamson, yep.
Yeah. And it was only because I was a fan of the movie. And I used to go to this bookstore in Charleston, South Carolina called the Book Nook. And we lived on the Air Force Base there. And it was right across the highway over the barbed wire covered fence I could see from my backyard. And I used to go over there all the time and just sort of look through the bookshelves and whatnot. And I was more into, like, special effects makeup and Fangoria and Gore Zone and all that stuff more than comics.
Cool.
But they had comics there, and I saw that. And because I was a fan of the Star Wars movies, I was like, oh, I'll have to check that out. And so I bought that paperback, and I still have it to this day. And Archie did put an inscription in there for me. It still has my home room, my middle school home room number, and my name in pencil written on the inside front cover. And that year, I decided that I was going to recreate that entire book on 8.5 by 11 typing paper with ballpoint pens and markers.
Wow.
And I copied every fucking page out of that book.
That's really cool.
And we had just moved to Charleston from a different... My dad was military, so we moved about every 12 to 18 months. And we moved right at the beginning of the summer, so I couldn't make friends in school like I normally would. So I spent the entire 3 months in my room doing that. And when we started school, I managed to talk the school and the art teacher at the school into allowing me to post pages that I had drawn from that book on the cork bulletin board as you're standing in line to go into the lunchroom.
That's great.
So there were, like, new pages that, like, every week when you would come in. But, I mean, it was just me aping Al, you know, total copycat shit. But
that's cool, though. Yeah. Come on, you're a kid. That's all right.
Well, yeah, I was 12, so.
Yeah.
But when I got to work for Arch, you know, and I didn't even make the connection initially who he was when I first got the job. So I was hired, and you know, I knew kind of who he was, you know, with him being over at Marvel and Epic and you know, his history with, like, Vampirella and Creepy and all that kind of stuff.
You bet.
But I didn't really know about all that stuff until later. Because after I started working for him, obviously I went back and like dug through, you know, long boxes and comic shops and like sought out his stuff and was just absolutely in awe that I was actually, you know, talking to this guy on the phone every day, you know, for four and a half years. But that, I feel like I have this really cool connection with Arch because, and by the way, that's what he told us to call him. So I'm not going beyond my allowance here.
Well, you worked with him. It's cool.
but, you know, I feel like I have this really cool connection with him. Like, you know, my God, 20 years before I ever even met the man. Because that was literally the very, and I'm not bullshitting you, that was literally the first comic book I ever paid money for.
That's very cool.
That he wrote. And then ended up working for the guy. And he was incredible. He was, like I said, he just left us alone to do our job. And not to say he wasn't involved or distant or anything, but he was smart. He knew when to step in and make comments and when to, you know, let James and me just kind of do what we wanted to. And I think the entire time I worked for him, I think he only raised his voice at me one time, and it was over a cover. And by the way, he was right. But I would always have to turn in, he always asked me to turn in like two or three different sketches for each cover. And this is a small aside, but when we first started the series, it was to be black and white color covers, pen and ink and color covers. But then he knew I wanted to paint. So after I turned in the cover to issue zero, which is part of the 0 hour thing, he went back to DC and said, listen, Tony wants to paint covers and I really want him to do it. So you should make it happen.
Awesome.
And so that's why there is a black and white cover in existence that never got used for issue zero. And then I ended up painting all the covers for the entire series. So, and that was a huge step for Archie to fight for that because it was an expensive endeavor to add that onto the budget of the book at the time. But he was incredible. But the cover that he hollered at me about, I don't remember exactly which cover it was, but I'd always do two or three sketches, like I said, and turn them in, and then he would go over them and call me. Because this was before the days of email, kids, where we actually had to get on the phone and talk to our editors and interact with other human beings. God, I miss that shit. And I try to do that as much as I can nowadays, but everyone wants to just do the email thing, you know?
I hear you, man.
But anyway, so Archie looked at these sketches, and my wife has always been sort of my touchstone, my muse to sort of go to and say, what do you think? Here's this. Is this shit or is it good? Should I go in a different direction? Whatever. And she's always right on the money with it. And Stacy always, and I'm not kidding here, every cover I did on that entire series, from regular issue to trade paperback to poster, whatever, Stacy always picked the same goddamn sketch that Archie did without fail. And she said, okay, I like number two. That's going to be the one. I'm like, and I never agree with her. I was always like, no, I'm not that crazy about that one. Because you always have your favorite that you put your energy into.
Sure.
And then you shit two other ones out. And it's always one of the ones that you shit out that the editors pick.
And these are roughs, I'm assuming, right? These are...
Yeah, they're thumbs.
And, yeah.
And then you go on to do like a more finished prelim beyond... And well, back then, anyway. Nowadays, I've been doing it long enough now to where people trust me to sort of do my thing, and I don't have to do as much prelim work.
Okay.
But he called me and we started talking about the sketches and he's like, I like number two. And I'm like, I'm really feeling this other one. I really dig this one. I really think that's going to be the one that's going to be strong. And we went back and forth for a few minutes and he finally just interrupted me in mid-sentence and raised his voice and said, we're going to go ahead with number two. And that's the end of it. And I was so flabbergasted that I couldn't say anything to him but yes, sir. And I've never called that. He always told me to call him Arch. I'd never called that man sir from the first day I'd met him. Not from lack of respect or anything, but he always insisted that we call him, you know, Arch.
Sure.
And so I just, yes, sir. And, God, I wish I could remember what cover that was now. The story would be way better. But no, that was the only time he ever hollered at me. And I had a pretty strained relationship with my father at that time, and prior to me getting into comics. And Archie was just incredible. He was such a gentle guy, and just, you know, aside from, everybody knows his writing, and they've worked with him and whatever, but the man was just a really cool fucking human being. I mean, just a really sweet guy. I mean, I remember one of the times when I went up to New York, that he had a photograph in a frame on his shelf in his office of him in some pajamas. Like the old school Victorian pajamas where they look like a dress, you know?
Like a nightshirt?
Yeah, like a nightshirt with like the cap on your head and all that shit where you're carrying like a little candle in your hand and
like he's screwed.
And shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, what in the hell is that? And he told me that it was like one day where everybody was supposed to wear their pajamas to work that day. It was called PJs at Work Day or some shit like that. And so Archie comes in that. I don't know if that's actually what he wore at home, but he got on the damn subway like that shit. Oh, I'm sure he had an overcoat or whatever.
Outstanding. But,
that was amazing. And he was a really funny guy, and you know, just a really sweet dude. He really just made the job not even feel like a job. I mean, you know. I miss him. I miss him. And him getting sick and the cancer finally, you know, taking him, that really took the wind out of my sails, as far as being on the book is concerned. And that was really the major reason why I left Starman when I did. I just couldn't do it anymore. Now, I did stay on and do covers for a while.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I think into the 80s. No. It only went to 80.
I was going
to
say 70 or 80. Yeah, yeah.
But no, it was the end of the 60s.
Okay.
And then my then studio partner, Andrew Robinson, I suggested him to take over. And he did just an amazing job at that point. And then, you know, James wanted to do this whole space thing. And I was I've said this before in the press, I bet. I was very vocal about saying, look, I think that's retarded, and I don't want any part of that. And I said to James at the point, and he'll tell you this, I did too, that if you take him into space, I'm leaving. I'll quit. That's it. I'm done. And then Archie got sick again, and he died. And then James decided he was going to do the space thing. And so I said, fuck it. I'm gone. That's it.
Oh, leading
and,
up. Go ahead.
And it was actually kind of fitting because my last issue was 45, and that was when Jack was leaving to go into space. And me kind of segueing out at that point, I think, was the perfect timing.
Man, I remember that arc. You know, I love that book, and I was shocked that I loved that book because I'm a huge Golden Age fan and didn't expect you guys, and you know, I know James is a big Golden Age fan. At the time, maybe I didn't put it together that, you know, this was the same guy that did that great Golden Age Elseworlds story. But what I loved was, in your visuals, you made Opal City this great kind of, you know, Valentine to, you know, the great cities of those black and white films. I mean, it still had the architecture that, you know, really only seems to exist anymore in, you know, those great old films when you'd see the Art Deco skyscrapers and really just this whole Art Deco city and everything.
Oh, well, that just came from when James and I started the book. He said, I don't want this to be in Gotham. I don't want this to be in Metropolis. I want to create a new city, something just for Starman. And I thought that was fantastic. And James had this idea of there being this city called Opal, and this river ran through it that went right down to the coast. So we never were specific about exactly where Opal was in the U.S. But I like to think it was close to the East Coast.
Okay.
In a fictional world.
Sure.
And Seven Colors River, which was a play on, you know, the opal and all the different colors.
Yes.
In an opal. But he liked the idea that it was this amazingly cool sort of Art Deco city in the 1920s and 30s. And there was this huge architectural boom at that point, like with New York and Chicago and a lot of other major metropolitan cities at that time. And then they went through the Depression in the 30s. And industry just, especially architecture and construction, just died. And so literally, and if you look at, it was one of the annuals that we did, or I think, remember the huge map I did?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
And I think, wasn't that one of the annuals, I think? Or maybe an 80-page giant, I'm not sure. But at any rate, James and I talked about it at length, and we liked the idea that Opal sprang out of, like, a flatland area where it almost resembled, like, the Emerald City in Wizard of Oz. Where you're looking at a completely flat area, and then boom, there's this huge, these deco spires shooting up out of nothing. And but once you get into the city, if you looked at it aerial view from like a plane or a chopper, the actual shape of the deco part of the city was a crescent moon, and the two tips of the crescent moon crossed the Seven Colors River. Can you picture this?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the rest of the moon was on the left-hand side of the Seven Colors. And in the very heart of the city, which sort of bled into the left-hand and the right-hand side of Opal, were the original streets of Opal when it was settled in the 1800s, which we called Old Town. Which is where Shade lived and
yep.
And did his deal. So we had this Victorian sort of rundown, rotting heart of the city that ran across both sides in the middle, and then these spires, and we tried to keep it to where like almost like all the architecture never progressed past like the early 30s.
Yeah. Well, and it fit the character because this is a character who really did, you know, love everything retro. And you know, that's the thing. I really think, and it makes sense because I look at Starman and I look at Ex Machina, and both series are more about people. And certainly in the case of Ex Machina, which was a much more grounded series. But as you say, Starman, yes, there were superheroes and supervillains there, but, you know, and the Shade was an incredible character, and everything you guys did with the Shade is just amazing. But, you know, it was the Bobo Benettis. It was Sadie.
Bobo was amazing. I loved him.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're right. It was really about Ted and his two boys.
Yes.
That's Jack and David. That's the heart of the series. It was about family. And beyond all the grandiose things that happened, his adventures in space and Grundy and Mikhail coming to Earth,
yep.
And you know, everything that happened in the series, it was really all in the end about Ted and his two boys, you know? And that's what attracted me to the whole thing to begin with, was that grounded element, you know? And God, you wouldn't believe the letters that James and I got over the years from guys going, and girls sometimes going, you know, my relationship with my dad like sucks so bad, and this book like empowered me to like reach out to my dad and try to make things right and mend those broken bridges. You know, I mean, I'm not kidding. I mean,
oh no, I buy it.
Letter after letter like that over the years.
See,
you know?
And I had a great relationship with my father, and it was when Jack and Ted finally, you know, were able to connect. that I kind of realized, you know, I was lucky. I had that relationship. We enjoyed those old things. There, I know in James' script early on, he's listening to Hughes Corporation's Rock the Boat. And he hears the voice, and he says, "Man, that sounds like Nat King Cole." And my father made the same observation when I was a little kid. And I'm like, "Who's Nat King Cole?" And he puts the music on, and I'm like, "Wow, that does sound like Nat King Cole. That's really neat." And I really became a huge Nat King Cole fan from that point on because of my dad and because we liked Rock the Boat, which is ridiculous.
I love Nat. Has just got like butter for a voice. That's
you bet,
amazing.
Man. Well, yeah. I'm embarrassed to put Nat King Cole and the Hughes Corporation on the same shelf there, but yeah.
No. I love all things old.
Me too, man. Well, I can tell.
I was born in the wrong era, but no, my favorite time period is the 1940s. I can't even tell you why. Can anybody really tell you why they love what they love aside from, oh, I love it? You know, I mean, just the aesthetics and people talked a certain way and they treated their fellow man in a certain way, and there was respect for your elders and men dressed like men.
Yep.
And women dressed like women. and people cared about things. Not that we don't now, but it's just, you either get it or you don't. I could explain it to death, but with the 40s, you either get it and you adore it at the level that I do, or there's no way I can explain it to you.
Well, I know, and we're going to talk about this, but, you know, your future collaborator, B. Clay Moore, that's the way he and I connected, was, you know, our love for retro things, and I'm a big 40s guy as well, so it doesn't surprise me. And no, your art, I think, really touched on that, and that's what we saw in Starman. We saw a very modern man in Jack who loved, you know, his nostalgia, and I think that came through.
And that was a great connection for him with his dad, you know?
Yeah, it was his love for the ideal of what his dad was, more so than initially than the man himself, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
I mean, he loved what Starman represented more than really a direct connection to who his father was at that point in time, in the current time.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's dude, I'm telling you, I really love that series, and you know, and I was really excited to hear when you were transferring over to Ex Machina. Again, I'm like, this is going to be cool, and the idea for the story was really exciting. I'm a sucker for politics. I'm a big political junkie, and again,
isn't that crazy that Machina actually worked? Isn't that fucking nuts?
Yes,
I still can't believe that it actually worked, and we did 50 issues.
Well,
I would have never thought. When I took the job, I thought we might get through like an arc or two. Not that I had no faith in Brian's work, but I just didn't think that people would be into
a politics book.
A politics, yeah. I mean, it's crazy. I still look back and go, wow.
But it was great because it managed to, for the most part. I mean, there were times when it certainly chose sides in terms of liberal versus conservatism, but I also think that it was, you know, first of all, that it was local politics, I think, made it much more of an interesting thing as opposed to the national debates.
Yeah, very hyper-focused on New York, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing. And I mean, it's just, it had that, it was the right book at the right time, and I feel that way about Starman, too. And obviously, I don't think there was any calculation that this would be the right time for either of those books, but clearly that was the case.
Yeah, and dude, don't think for a moment that I don't sit around daily going, wow, they say lightning never strikes twice in the same place, but for me it did. I mean, I've only done two monthlies in my entire career, and both have been just amazingly successful. And I'm not saying that's because of me. I'm just saying that it was the right material, like you just said, at the exact right time.
Yeah, but it didn't hurt. I mean, clearly you brought the visual sensibility to you know. I mean, that's, dude, you're carrying. I'm a big writer's guy, and I'm trying to do more interviews with artists, and I always have tremendous respect for art. The bottom line is that's three quarters of the book. It really is. I mean, the story is a foundation, and I think it's an important foundation. And the best comics come when it's great art and great story. But visually, that's what gets you in the door. And a lot of times, sometimes that's what keeps you, too.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier Azzarello and
Rizzo, yeah.
Rizzo. And you're right. I mean, the artist does have to live with a book much longer than the writer does. But that does not mean that it's any less either guy's project.
Oh, but, sure.
Brian has always been very accommodating as far as, you know, when he does interviews or talks to anybody, he's like, oh, you know, I write this, I wrote that. But, you know, Tony is the guy that has to take those words and translate them into a workable story. You know, something that's going to work on the page. And if you get paired with a guy who can't tell a story, and I mean, that goes both ways. You could have a very accomplished artist who's a great storyteller who gets paired with, you know, a shit writer, and vice versa, then you've got a disaster on your hands.
Sure.
But Brian was always the very definition of collaboration. I mean, he is my absolute favorite person I've ever worked with. He always said to me, with every script from day one, if you read a page that I've written and you can think of a better way to do it than what I put down, please rock it. But I always tried, if I wanted to diverge from what he wrote, I always tried to either email him or call him and get on the phone and say, hey, I know you wrote this, but check this out. Here's this idea for this. And I didn't always have time to do that, but I would say about 75 to 80% of the time when I wanted to diverge from what he wrote, I always did that. And he was always very open. And there were a few times where he said, no, well, I wrote that scene that way because it's got to have these certain beats to it. And if you delete one beat or you add a beat to that particular sequence, it's going to screw things up and it's not going to feel right when you change scenes. So he was always very conscious of the beats, you know?
Whether
it's like storytelling is like a good rhythm in a song, like a good hook in a song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that guitar solo or that favorite bit of a tune that you dig. And if it's not right, if it's not there, and all the beats are not in place, then you don't like it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't resonate with you. It doesn't ring true.
Sure. Was there a specific character that changed from your visuals from a different way than Brian originally intended?
Oh, the Great Machine.
Yeah, talk about that. I saw that in print, and I would appreciate hearing your words in terms of the design of the superhero's look in Ex Machina.
When Brian, for the record, Brian actually conceived of Ex Machina and pitched it to Wildstorm 1 year before I was brought in. And they searched on and on and on for an artist on the book. And couldn't find the right guy. And this is what I'm told by Brian and Wildstorm editorial. And then somebody, I don't know if it was Brian or somebody, I was pitching a creator-owned series to Scott Dunbeer at the time. And they passed on it. And then he was like, well, would you be willing to read anything that we're developing? And maybe, you know, get on board. And I'm like, sure, yeah, whatever you want to shoot me, I'll read it. And they sent me Machina, and I read it in 15 minutes. I called them back. I was like, I have to do this. This is amazing. I've never read anything like it, and I totally want to do this. And in Brian's pitch, his description of the Great Machine was a guy in tights with a cape. That's it.
Okay. All right.
And so I had an initial conversation with Brian on the phone, and just as you might imagine, it was rather stilted and uncomfortable. We didn't know each other, and I had never read Brian's work prior to this pitch. Never read Why.
Okay.
Nothing. I didn't even know who he was. So he knew who I was from Starman, but you know, I'm embarrassed. I had not read anything that he had done. I don't read that much, though, so it's no slot against him. But so we're talking about the character and everything, and I said, listen, this whole thing is really grounded and based on reality and kind of, you know, ripped from the headlines kind of feel to it. So why don't we ground our characters in the very same way? Why don't we treat everything visually, right down to the last detail, exactly like that? And he was like, okay, what are you thinking? I'm like, well, this guy can control machines. So to me, if we're going to operate under that mindset, it makes sense to me that he would, his entire, quote, costume, for lack of a better term, because I don't know if you can really call that, but would all be something that you or me could go to, like an Army-Navy store.
Absolutely.
And you could buy all this stuff surplus off the shelf and just put your whole, you know, outfit together like that. And then, of course, he was an engineer, and Mitchell was having dreams after he got his ability about these machines and stuff. So he actually dreamt the jetpack. And then his friend Kremlin, who was a mechanic, helped him build it. And I was like, okay, well, it makes sense to me that Mitchell would surround himself with tech and machinery. That's his ability, so that's, to me, that's where his comfort zone would be.
Sure.
So I said, okay, well, let's make his costume sort of utilitarian, you know? He's got a jetpack. He's got wings on it. He's flying around, but he doesn't know what the hell he's doing. He's a bumbling idiot, like any of us would be if we tried to do anything like that. We would get our ass kicked like Mitchell did on a regular basis. We would crash into shit like Mitchell did on a regular basis. And if you're going to have a jetpack on and be flying around doing that kind of crap, okay, you're going to have a helmet so you don't crack your skull open the first time you crash, which you did this time. You're going to have something to protect your body. So I just automatically assumed, okay, one of those leather outfits that those damn biker dudes wear. You know, those reinforced knee and ass.
Sure.
Leather outfits. And so that's what that's all based on. It's like real shit. And his chest protector jetpack mount that he's wearing, and I'm not kidding, this is actually, and the little bit that's on the back of the jetpack that's like ribbed kind of, it's hard to explain over the phone, but there's like this little designing a little deal that's on the back of his back that's like scoops over the top of the jetpack.
Yeah, yeah.
In the initial designs. And that is actually, and the chest piece that he's wearing, which is one big solid fiberglass piece, is actually from my best friend in high school, Brian Fry, who did digital covers with me on Starman for the trade paperbacks. He's an awesome cartoonist. His sister was in a terrible car accident in high school, and she spent like over a year bedridden, recovering, and she wore a harness or a cast, like a body cast. But it was in the form of this chest piece that you literally slid on over the top of you like a knight armor.
Sure.
And then she had the metal halo that goes around your head, and the screws go in.
I know exactly what you're talking about. We had a kid that had that in my high school, and not only that, yeah. as a boxing fan, I covered Vinny Pazienza, who had a hairline fracture of his neck and had to wear a halo for years. So yeah, I remember that absolutely.
Yeah, and like so that's what all that stuff is. It's all based on that stuff.
Interesting.
Because Brian actually gave me that stuff when his sister healed up and he gave me the harness and all that stuff. So we actually had that in the studio when I got the job, and I put that on my model when I did my original pencil designs for the character.
Insane. And, you know, I'm a sucker for jetpacks, man. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I think I still love Adam Strange and all the various characters.
Oh, I love Adam Strange, yeah.
So that's – I think that certainly helped. Now, you mentioned your models, and I want to talk about that because, again, in preparation for our talk, I've been reading and trying to watch some video here and there. There's a great video thing that the guys from the Isotope put up on their website on Ex Machina, and I encourage people to check it out. There's some great video interviews on there and great designs of your pages and stuff. But one thing that you do with your art, and it reminds me of John Ford having his pet actors that he would continually go to from the 40s through the 60s and stuff. But you have this cast of, like, models that you use. Were these the same people that you maybe used in the Starman days as well, or was this a specific cast for Ex Machina?
No, it was very specialized, very specific to Ex Machina. I try my best to... I treat every new project I do like a film. I'm a huge film buff, and I think maybe in a different life that would have been what I got into, or maybe I'll get into it later in life. I have no idea, but that's how I approach everything I do. But no, with Starman, it was... I was young, and I just got into doing photo-referenced work and had no idea what I was doing. So I cast myself as Jack.
Interesting.
And
okay.
And it's out there. I mean, look through the omnibus and whatnot, and there are photographs of me in there from 20 years ago when I was young and skinny, and I wasn't a fat old weirdo.
Don't worry, man.
But no, I figured, oh, okay, I'm doing my first monthly. I need a model. I want to shoot all this stuff. So I need a model that I can get a hold of and can be at my beck and call whenever I need him. Ooh, that's me. So that's how that happened. And then I just sort of cast the rest of the characters to physical type with who I had around me. And my then inker, my longtime inker for like 10 plus years, Ray Snyder, was my model for the Shade.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and he's just got a terrific face. And every time you see the Shade in all the stuff I drew, I mean, it's absolutely recognizable as, okay, oh, shit, that's the Shade. I mean, I could have put him in a Mexican sombrero and Hawaiian shorts, and you would go, shit, that's the Shade. He must be on vacation. but no, so I cast the rest of the book the same way, and then with Ex Machina, I wanted different faces, and I've always used sort of the same people for general stuff, and I can change them to be whatever I need them to be. I have my go-to people,
sure,
you know,
sure,
my stable of models who are willing to do whatever I want. And but when it comes to specialized stuff, like I had a guy named Chad Fletcher who modeled for me for my Doctor Strange work at Marvel, and he was just absolutely physically perfect for that role. But then when it came time for Ex Machina, my wife and I had just bought the house that we're in, and we were at, it was about, I guess, about five, 6 years after we moved in here, we were at a neighborhood Christmas party, and everyone from the neighborhood was there, and we were walking around the house, and I had just gotten the job, and I was like, all right, I'm gonna do this, and this is the first time I ever actually decided to do this, like, deliberately. I said, I'm going to do this like a damn movie. I'm going to cast this book. You know, people do that in message board threads all the time. Cast
sure.
the movie.
Absolutely.
And I said, that's what I'm going to do here. I'm going to cast this book, and I'm going to find people that live in my neighborhood. So I see them all the time. So hopefully they'll be available more frequently than hired models or whatever, and do it like that. So I literally poured myself a drink and walked around the Christmas party and said, and I had a list of the characters in my hand, and Brian gave me no physical description, whatever. He
cool.
just said, Mitchell's this guy, Kremlin's an old Russian fucker, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I just went around and sort of tried to put together a visual in my head of what I thought these characters should look like. And I literally, one after the other, I walked to that party, and I was like, shit, there's Mitch. Christ, there's Kremlin. Fuck, there's so-and-so. There's, oh, shit, there's Bradbury. And I'm not kidding.
I believe it.
It was like a diamond bullet in your forehead.
Fantastic.
And so I just had to go up to each one of these 15 people that I used over the years and say, hey, I'm Tony. I live up the street on the corner. I got the big gray house. I'm a comic book artist, and I want to shoot a bunch of pictures of you acting like this dude for the next 6 years. And thank God every single person that I talked to just flipped over the idea and were like, awesome, that's terrific, I'd love to.
Very cool.
And none of them even knew about comics. They had no idea, you know.
So
I was very, very lucky.
It sounds like it. I mean, they struck me as real people, and they obviously were. So that's even cooler. I mean, it's.
And I think that helps readers, I think, identify with the characters as much as they do, is that they are based on real people. So, you know, and the actors I used for those characters over the years got so attached to the characters they were playing, because we would actually run through the script before we would do a shoot.
Oh, that's great. Like, so they really were familiar with...
I mean, I'd pass out scripts to everybody, and we would actually run through the script as we were blocking the scenes.
Very interesting.
Just like a stage play. And we'd rehearse things. Oh, what about this? Let's try this angle. And I would shoot everything. Obviously, I was directing the entire shoot. And I'm saying by like the second or third year, my models were actually giving me suggestions. Seriously, they would say, Eric O'Dell played Bradbury for me. And actually, interesting fact, his real-life wife, Greta, played Angotti.
Very interesting. Wow.
do you remember the scene when Angotti and Mitch were chasing down that fucker on the motorcycle?
Go ahead.
Okay. And Mitchell basically had to go, quote, off the grid for a while.
Okay.
And Bradbury, being his head of security, was like, I'm not comfortable with this. And Gotti goes to him and says, hey, I'm going to go with Mitch. You're not coming. We have something we have to do, blah, blah, blah. And Bradbury's pissed off. And then he looks at Gotti and says, I'll give you 2 hours, or something like that. And I said, when we're doing the shoot, I said, okay, Eric, when you say 2 hours, I want you to hold your hand up and give a peace sign like you're saying 2 hours, and really, you know, shove it in her face like you're pissed at her, like fuck you, I'm not giving you any more than that. And Eric said, dude, what if I held up one finger on my left hand, my index finger, and then flipped her off with my right hand and put them side by side, so it would be like, I'll give you 2 hours. And I was like, oh, we're still doing that. And that's how we shot it, and that's how I drew it and put it in the book.
Outstanding. Very funny.
And that's one example of dozens over the years that my models were actually to the point where they knew their characters so well that they were like, what? Nah, my guy would not do that. Because they all read the book, too. So they were... you know, just so into what they were doing. It was just incredible.
That's really cool. Well, you see, no reason again to go back and start picking through old issues.
There's all kinds of shit in there. There's another scene, too, where Angotti's, like, you know, sticking her index finger through a loophole in her other hand, like she's banging something, you know, like...
Sure, sure. Now, that I seem to remember. Go ahead.
And then, like, I got guys walking through the halls of City Hall, you know, in some of the dialogue-heavy scenes. And I'm like, you know what? If I worked in an office and I had a really good friend who worked in, like, a different part of the office than me, if I passed them in the hall, I'd, like, flick them a bird and say, ah, you're a prick or whatever. And so we had stuff like that going on in the shoots, like, all the time in the background.
What about set dressing? What about set design? I mean, were you able to go to you know, a bunch of real city halls and, you know, shoot some photo ref and everything too?
We did. Whenever I could, I would actually go and you know, go to, like, you know, the city hall here in Macon and say, hey, can I come in? I'm doing this book. You have to explain who you are and that you're not some weirdo off the street.
Sure.
And whatnot. But whenever I could do location shooting, I always did because it makes it more believable. And if there was a specific prop, like Mitchell's helmet or a ray gun or goggles or whatever, I made sure I had that stuff. But aside from that, it was just shooting everybody in what they were wearing on the day I called them. And a lot of stuff was shot in my hallway.
Okay.
In my house. But what I would do is, I would take, like, the photo that I would shoot in my hall, and I would take... I would look at the perspective lines on the photograph, and I would draw a grid on the page with a ruler and put my perspective points in, and then I could change the background into whatever location I needed it to be.
Okay.
So a lot of the photo reference that you look at will be guys in, like, you know, boxer shorts and, you know, sweatpants and whatever. And then when you see the drawn page, they're wearing three-piece suits and, you know, jetpacks.
Now, the book always had that a couple years of flashback versus whatever was happening at the present time of the book. And obviously the whole book took place within that one term of Mitchell's tenure as mayor. Did it ever, as the years would progress, and maybe this is a question more for Brian, but did you even in conversation with the both of you, did it ever feel like the reality you guys were doing on the page, what, you know, did you have to worry about, well, what was really happening in the real world? I mean, how much of that changed as, you know, the book progressed and years would go on?
It did. And we had the benefit of working ahead.
Sure.
Because the book was set slightly in the past, you know.
Right.
When we were actually working. And Brian was very, very cognizant of, you know, the press and what was going on in New York City, and not just the city, but in New York City politics, and really researched heavily. So most everything that we did in the book was based either literally or loosely on something that was going on in New York City at the time that Brian would set the date on those particular scenes. And then we would just wrap that around our characters and our scenarios and tweak it and, you know, move it around to suit our needs, basically.
It must have been interesting, too, from a visual standpoint, because you had that one story that always stands out for me early on was the painting of Abe Lincoln with the N-word across him and everything, and the objections to putting that out, you know, in a public display. And I remember... I want to say, wasn't it the elephant art that was done with, like, feces or something like that? That was the...
Oh, yeah. Or there was all kinds of stuff. There was the piss Jesus and...
Oh, yes, I forgot.
Oh, no, it's called the piss Christ.
I forgot about the piss Christ. Yes, of course.
Oh, yeah, and then there was, like, there was something with... Oh, it was elephant dung.
Yes.
That was smeared... in blackface on a statue of Mary.
There you go. Yes, exactly. That's what it was.
That's what it was.
Yep.
And we referenced all that stuff in the story. That was a direct play on that. And actually, there was an exhibit that was done in either New York or Brooklyn. I want to say it was the Brooklyn Museum of Art, where I think what Brian wrote was it was an exhibit called. 30 under 30.
Okay.
Or 20 under 20. I can't remember what it was. But 20 up-and-coming artists or 30 up-and-coming artists under the age of 30. And forgive me, I drew 50 issues of the fucking book, so I can't remember every tiny detail. But, no, it was something like that. And then, like, so we focused on Trish and that particular painting that she did. But, yeah, it was all totally ripped from the headlines. Not that Brian was, you know, left of original IPs, because God knows he's not.
Yeah, clearly not.
But he wanted it to be very, very, very grounded in reality, just like my designs for the costumes and the fact that the city looked exactly like New York should look. And I mean, I even went to the lengths of, you know, going up to New York a couple times a year. My brother lives up there, and just shooting roll after roll of film. For the most part, not of the major landmarks, but I would always shoot like manhole covers and trash cans and phone booths and metal accordion gates that you pull closed and lock over a storefront when you shut down for the day, and street lights and street signs.
Sure.
And pigeons gathered around a trash can in Little Italy, you know, eating seeds out of the snow, and just all the little things that make New York, New York. And it was so much appreciated by fans that Brian took such care with his writing, and I took such care with the visuals. And the New Yorkers are, I think, some of our biggest fans on the book, because they're like, wow, you guys fucking get it.
Yeah, down to even the last story arc where, you know, the call came out to attack and everything went crazy, and him figuring out that it was one of the public radio stations, and the mere fact that, you know, New York being the large city that is, and this is the broadcast nerd in me, knowing that there are more than one or two, you know, NPR stations in New York. And you know, as opposed to, you know, as you go further in the country and stuff, where it usually is one city, one NPR station and stuff, but not New York.
Oh, yeah, here in Macon, we have one.
There you go. No, there you go, man. So, I you felt the authenticity, and I'm sure that doesn't surprise me that New Yorkers love the book. It doesn't surprise me at all.
One of my favorite bits in the entire series was, it was during... I can't remember the name of the arc now. Forgive me again, fans. I'm sorry. But it was when all the rats were fucking everybody up. And I did this panel. Brian wrote this panel where there's like a manhole cover that's like coming open, and the rats are just like spilling out of it. And so I went online and did some research to find out exactly, because I had shot a ton of manhole covers when I was up there last, right before that arc. But I couldn't find anything specific to what I wanted to use, because they vary from one point in the city to another. I mean, they're not all the same, because some are older, some are newer. They differ and vary from one burg to the next. And in my research, I came across this photograph of a manhole for the city of New York, and it actually said on the design, stamped in metal, "Made in India." And I was like, oh, shit, I have to use this. That's the manhole cover I'm going to put on. Because, I mean, New York City's truly the melting pot.
Absolutely.
You know, And so I said, that has to be the manhole cover that I use. So that's what I drew into the book. And my God, the comments and letters we got on that, like, oh, my God, I see those all the time. And they're like, very few people realize that half the damn manhole covers in New York City are actually manufactured in India. And I have one guy send me a letter going, and those things are actually handmade in these little villages.
Oh, my God.
By Indian people.
Wow.
It's crazy. And I think Brian actually saw a little mini documentary on how they were made.
That's
and
very
they
funny.
Do it old school. Nuts.
Like on an anvil? Like hammering it out on an anvil or whatever?
Whatever, yeah.
Wow. That's crazy, man. So, you know, it's done. And like you said, we said it at the beginning. I mean, you know, a little bit of regret or more relief or a combination? I mean, how do you feel after it's all done?
I don't feel anything.
Okay.
I just did Baltimore Comic Con, and that was one of the first questions I was asked when I showed up, and that was the first convention I did after we finished the book. And the guy kind of looked at me, you know, with this incredulous expression. I'm like, let me explain to you. The reason that I don't feel anything is because, well, I do feel some relief because having done a quote, monthly book for 6 years, and by, for the record, fuck you all, we average 10 issues a year, so suck me. 50 issues in 6 years, that's 10 a year, bitches, plus trades and specials, so blow me.
Attaboy.
So yeah, there is some relief there having finished it. But you know what? I was so close to the material when I was doing it. So I've read all the script, but I was so close to the material having to deconstruct Brian's scripts and craft the pages and pay attention to my storytelling and, you know, organize the shoots and just the execution of the work, that I really can't comment on the actual story or the body of work objectively. So what I'm really, really looking forward to is I'm actually finishing the last two covers tonight and tomorrow. I'm finishing the wraparound cover for Volume 10 of the trades for Machina.
Okay.
And I'm finishing the fifth hardcover volume cover tomorrow. So what I'm looking forward to is when those are all out and published, I can't wait to get all five hardcovers with no ads, no 30-day wait period between singles, in a hardcover book on glossy paper, and as a fan of Brian Vaughn's writing, to sit down and for the very first time read Ex Machina objectively and just as a fan. I can't wait.
Cool.
I mean, I know what happens, obviously, but I think, you know, I forgot so much, you know, of the little nuances and the little things that Brian did and the seeds he planted, you know, here, and then 12 issues later, they sprout, and, you know, just it's a tour de force on his part. And I'm just so excited to sit and actually read it as a fan.
That's cool. Very cool, man. Well, yeah, I'll, you know, we'll give it more time to gain more perspective, and maybe it's something that we'll come back to in a future interview or something when you're able to talk about it a little more objectively.
But it did break my heart, though. And no spoilers for the trade waiters.
Fair enough.
It's not out yet, but
right.
It, you know, a lot of stuff in there just broke my heart.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's one scene in particular, and I think you know what I'm talking about.
I'm guessing that I do.
In issue 50.
Yes. No, I'm guessing that I do. The fate of one of the characters.
Yeah, that was extraordinarily difficult to draw that. That was hard. Well, and plus my model for Kremlin actually died of cancer this year.
Oh, wow. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. And he and his wife divorced years ago, and he moved away. So I haven't been able to use him for several years. But he's absolutely the heart and the soul of that character. And when he passed this year, it was pretty hard. Just because, you know, I'm still drawing his face and I don't know, it's weird.
No, I understand. And again, going back to what we were talking about with fathers and sons too, I mean, Kremlin kind of represents that, you know, to Mitchell in so many ways.
Oh,
so
he was absolutely the only father figure in Mitchell's life.
Yeah. No, man, up and down, man. Yeah. That whole book, I love those characters. It's funny, I came to the West Wing late because, like a nerd, it was up against Voyager, and I had to watch Star Trek every week because I'm a nerd. And so, yeah, I've come to watch it in reruns. So for me, it really was the Ex Machina cast that represented, when people would say it was the West Wing in comics, I saw enough of it that I knew what they meant as far as the comparison. But like you say, man, lightning struck twice for you. I think you were very fortunate to hook up with the writers that you did, and two very powerful books that came at important times, and I think will stand the test of time. I think they are books that we will look back at, and certainly we already do with Starman, but I think Ex Machina clearly is going to be another one of those significant books of the first 10 years of the 21st century.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that. I'm incredibly proud to have done the whole series, and I was lucky that early on, Wildstorm said, well, we probably have to put some contingency plans into place for fill-ins and things like that. And I immediately said, no, we're not going to do that. Or at least I don't want to do that. And I talked to Brian and said, here's my thing. This is the kind of book, and here's what I cast the whole thing on, like, real people. So they all have a very recognizable face and a personality. And with the kind of story that we're going to tell here, I just really think a disservice to the book if, you know, every 3, 4, 5, whatever issues, we have some guy come in and do a fill-in. And it's like a different artist every time. It's going to take people out of the story. You know, it's going to be like all of a sudden one of the main characters is walking in the room naked with a clown hat on, you know?
Sure.
And Brian immediately agreed with me and said, no, I totally agree. And so we went to Ben and said, you know, what can we do here? And he goes, well, I don't know. Let's talk about it. So long story short, what we did was we decided to do these, quote, specials that would give me a break when I needed one. But I insisted that the numbering on the regular series not be interrupted by the specials. I said it's really important to me that Brian and I do the entire run, all 50 issues, 1 to 50, and it not be interrupted. So if we're going to do these specials, let's number the specials 1 through whatever, however many of them that we do. So that when the book is finished, you know, Brian and I have this body of work that is uninterrupted, and quite frankly, I know that there have been a lot of people that have, you know, bitched and moaned in the press and on message boards about the lateness of this issue or that or whatever. But, you know, we always said to ourselves, okay, this issue might be late, whatever's going on. We had a lot of personal tragedy during the series with, you know, myself and JD and Brian. I mean, all of us went through a lot of major shit during those 6 years. But we always told ourselves, you know what? In the end, when the 50 issues are done, and there are 5 hardcovers and 10 trade paperbacks out on the stands, and we did it all. There's no fill-ins. It's all there consistently with one art team. Who's going to give a flying fuck?
Agreed.
If issue 22 was a month late.
Yep.
Guess what? Nobody.
Nope. No, you're right, man.
Because about halfway through the series, a lot of our readers, like, skipped off to trade letters. And that's fine, because, I mean, that's how I prefer to read books, is in trade.
Sure.
No ads, you don't have to wait, whatever. But no one's going to give a shit. When the body of work is done, if your publisher is patient enough with you and willing to foster, you know, your creativity, which Wildstorm has been absolutely brilliant, especially Jim Lee. He's just tremendous. He and Hank Knauss and Ben Abernathy are literally the three wise men of Ex Machina.
Understood. No, and I agree with you, man. I think it's funny. I was just listening to a podcast, and they were touting how much they love European albums. And that, you know, for the most part, you know, they're able to finish those stories at their own pace. And if it's, you know, 2 or 3 years in between albums, so be it. At the end, you've got this amazing story that's, you know, done by one writer and one artist. And they go, why can't American books be like that? And yet it is, and I'm not saying this specific podcast or blogger, but you do hear that chorus of people say, why can't these books stay on time? And that's just the way it is with serialized fiction. I mean, it's, do you want it now, or do you want it to be consistent?
Or do you, yeah, do you want it good?
Right.
Yeah, and me personally, I'm a fan, I'm a reader as well. I want my comics good, thank you very much.
No, I agree with you, man, and that's okay. I mean, that's why I really don't get angry. I mean, you know, everyone, and there's a lot of kids that read comics, and I can appreciate that, but guys like us that have been, you know, and actually in your case, like you said, you've only been doing it since regularly since you're 19, and you don't read a lot of books. For me, it's okay. As long as they finish the story, and again, the product is great. I mean, they just wrapped up Planetary, Warren and Cassidy, and, you know, that's great. I'm glad that, you know, they were able to tell the story that they did. And like you say, 10 years from now, people are going to look back. Who gives a flying fuck? It was, as you say, it was you guys, and you told the story that you wanted to tell, and it's a consistent quality story throughout.
And right? we didn't have to compromise, you know?
That'll do it for part one of our conversation with Tony Harris. Part two is coming up next Thursday, and in part two, we discuss Tony's attempts at getting a Comics Creators Guild organized and what's coming up in his future now that Ex Machina has wrapped up. This episode of Word Balloon was brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where, again, they offer a wide selection of hardcovers, trade paperbacks, essentials, omnibus editions, showcases, all at reduced prices. DC, Marvel, and Image in-stock trade titles are 37% off the standard retail price. For Dark Horse books, 42% off the standard retail price. In the case of Tony Harris, make sure you check out all the Ex Machina trade paperbacks. Catch up, because it's a great value. The standard retail price is $12.99 on trades. At InStockTrades.com, it's just $8.18. Or you can look at a great retrospective of Tony's entire career, Tony's Art and Skullduggery from Desperado and IDW. The standard retail price is $49.99, but at InStockTrades.com, it's just $34.99. Check out all the deals yourself. They're waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. John Sutcher saying thanks again for listening to Word Balloon. We appreciate your patronage, and of course you can find us not only at wordballoon.com, but on Tuesdays at iFanboy. Sometimes we do more than four episodes a month, and you find us on special days at iFanboy as well, just like today. Any questions or comments about the show, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Follow me on Twitter, John Word Balloon, or of course at my Facebook page under my name, John Suntress. And as always, subscribe to the Word Balloon feed, and you won't miss an episode. And make sure you check back on our archive of well over 300 interviews of comic creators. Until next time, thanks a lot for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.